Okay. You may have noticed I'm limping. Margot misunderstood the expression twisting your arm, and she twisted my leg to get me here. No. So today I would like to talk about a few things that I learned at Harvard. And so I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and attended a somewhat mediocre public high school, and thought that I had worked quite hard to in my sort of academic career there, and one day I got into Harvard, and I thought this was the most amazing thing that had happened. And I got to Harvard, and what I learned was what hard work really meant. I arrived on campus thinking I was going to do mechanical engineering, and then I looked at the list of classes and thought, no, I'm not doing mechanical engineering anymore. And I don't like the sound of those classes, but the sound of the classes I really like are these computer science ones, and they'll count until I can figure out what kind of engineering or whatever I'm going to do. And I had been programming since fourth grade. I started with the Logo Turtle, if anyone's familiar, where you write code and it draws pictures. You notice I work at Pixar, so that may have been fortuitous. And so I had been programming, but not in a hardcore kind of way, in a like a making pictures kind of way. And I loved programming, but it was sort of like this hobby, and it had never occurred to me to major in computer science until it took me all of like 2 weeks into CS50 to go, oh, duh, why am I not going to major in computer science? This is something I love. And so off I went, and I worked hard in CS50, and then I was rewarded with many long nights in the Science Center and in my dorm room. But then I got to CS51 with Harry Lewis, and then I really learned what working hard was. And CS51, I don't know if there's anyone in this room that hasn't taken it, but it was sort of the weed out class for computer science at that time, much more like organic chemistry was for the whole rest of the school that wanted to be doctors. You knew if you had worked hard and survived CS51 and you still loved programming, then you had probably made a good choice, was how I felt about it. And the problem was that it was a lot of work, and I found myself staying up all night at least 1 to 3 nights a week. And so I was in Strauss C, and all I had to do was look out my window and see the corner store there that here is not 7-Eleven, but I can't remember whatever it is. And it beckoned to me on those late nights. And so this is how I got through those long nights, was I'd buy a 6-pack of the powdered sugar donuts and a can of Mountain Dew. And I'm not sure how many years of my life I dismissed eating these things. But it really got me through those long nights. Now, the problem was I also played softball for Harvard. Here's a particularly bad picture of me doing it. It looks like I'm enjoying myself quite a lot. The problem with playing softball in Boston is that the weather is terrible. And so you have to fit your entire season into like 5 weeks, which meant we played 8 games a week. Now, this being Harvard, I know you're doing some math and saying there's only 7 days in the week. We would play a doubleheader on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. So I was doing that and staying up 1 to 3 nights a week for CS51. And then the softball team was nice enough to have at least 1 kegger a week. Which I was a freshman, of course, I was taking place in that. This is where I truly learned about working hard. It somehow was actually my best year in softball, I think, because it like actually shut my brain off because I was a complete zombie, but that's probably a different story. So I learned how to work hard, but there's sort of a subset to this too, which is when I arrived as a freshman, I'm trying to figure out how to manage this whole workload thing and this being away from home and school. And I decided to add on top of that getting a job. Not for the good reasons that normally come with that, but I had a boyfriend at the time who lived in Illinois, and I thought, I sort of did this calculation with the critical thinking that got me to Harvard, which was if I worked a job for maybe like a month, I could make enough money to buy a bus ticket because bus tickets are cheaper than plane tickets. And I could get to Illinois in time for Thanksgiving. So the important thing was to find the best paying job so I could work the least amount of time possible so I could get back to all my homework. And so I did a lot of research, which involves, I think, looking at flyers on posts. And it's possible you shouldn't take the job that advertises the most, but I did, and I ended up working for dorm crew, which is cleaning the bathrooms in the dorms. And it paid really well. And I went in, and of course they were happy to give me the job. And but they said, well, there's just one thing. We only have one dorm available right now, and it's your dorm. And so all of the people in my dorm, my first semester of freshman year, thought I was the girl that cleaned the bathrooms. Now, as you can see by this current picture of dorm crew, this is a very popular job. I was quite excited by this, much like the guys in this picture at that level. You know, and even when I did it, we didn't even have these nice backpack vacuums. That must be a new thing, so extra exciting. And so this is where I learned the lesson that you work hard, but try to work hard on the right thing. And so around this time, one of my teammates on the softball team, who was an upperclassman, got wind of what I was doing working in dorm crew. Now, this woman ended up being my first girlfriend later down the line, but that's another thing I learned at Harvard, but that's probably a different story for a different time. So this idea of work hard on the right thing, she says, you're quitting dorm crew, and I'm getting you a job in Harvard University Mail Services. And so she marched me down to the dorm crew office to make me quit. And so I told them, I'm really sorry, but I have to quit. And they said, you can't quit. We're giving you a promotion. And it became clear to me very fast, I might have been the only one actually cleaning the bathrooms for real in dorm crew, because I worked hard at whatever I put my mind to. And I want you to spend just a second thinking about what a bathroom for freshmen might be looking like, you know, away from home for the first time. Anyway, so I left that job. I turned down the promotion, of course, and I went to the Harvard University Mail Services, which was a fabulous job and paid just as well and was infinitely less disgusting, and came with my boss, who was a lady named Shirley, who started every sentence with, ah, shoot, or really probably more like, ah, shit. And she would regale us with stories of her weekend bingo wins and things like that. And so I learned some very important lessons here that carried well into my career at Pixar, which is obviously this sort of hard work and perseverance spent on something that you really love. I worked my butt off at Pixar, and I started in this very entry-level technical position doing rendering. And so I was doing coding there, but it wasn't anything that showed up concretely in the movies. It was more like scheduling renders and things like that. But I kept working hard, and it was a really magical time then where no one had any experience. And so at the end of my first movie, A Bug's Life, they said, well, what would you like to do? And you could sort of choose where you wanted to go. So I said, oh, I'd like to try modeling and lighting. And so off I went to figure those out. So on Monsters Incorporated, I don't know if any of you have seen it. This was, Margot has, okay. Nice. This was very exciting because this was actually the first code that I wrote that generated visuals in a movie. And so it was a simple piece of code, but it was some sine waves and some randomization and some artistic controls to make the leaves on this tree outside the window flap in the wind. And this was also a lesson for me that you can put a lot of work into something and no one will ever notice. That shot just keeps going and going and going. Okay, so the next thing I learned at Harvard was about barriers. And there's some very concrete barriers, like when my softball teammates took me to the Crimson Bar and Grill, insisting anyone can get into this bar, you just have to have any kind of ID. So they hand me an ID, they all go in, and I hand my ID to the bouncer. And it turns out that everyone doesn't get into the Crimson Bar and Grill, especially when the ID says that you're 28 and 5'9". So that ID had been handed down for an inappropriate number of years. And I discovered that that was a real barrier. When I started at Harvard, I understood that there were some other things that were more like perceived barriers. And so one of the most amazing things to me when I stepped on this campus was meeting other freshmen and learning that they had done things like the guy upstairs had started this public service sort of group in his community that had made huge strides, and he was just a freshman coming in. And then people who were doing groundbreaking science work and outreach in other countries, and all these things that I thought were reserved for adults, not kids. And so it was this real lesson to me about how to live life bigger and more boldly. You know, when I was in high school, all I was doing was trying to work on my, you know, getting good grades and SATs and playing sports and extracurriculars. And I was trying to figure out how to kind of make the nerdy, cool thing work out. So I'm still working on that. But all of these things with the barriers really comes into play at Pixar because having been there for 20 years, there's a lot of barriers that we've hit where we get to a movie like this is The Incredibles, and we had a director who had, it was his first movie at Pixar, and he had only ever done hand-drawn animation before, and so we storyboard the movie out first, so it's quick gesture drawings, and he drew out this scene, this here, where the mother tucks Violet's hair behind her ear. She has this nice, long, flowing black hair, and if you're going to draw that, it's no big deal. He looked at the room, and all the technical people in the room had turned sort of pale white. And he's like, well, what's the problem? And they said, well, like, long hair is an unsolved problem. We don't know how to do that. And tucking it behind her ear, are you kidding me? And he thought, well, like, these people are crazy. Like, what do you mean that's hard? And so he then went on to explain that this is a really important part of the story. This is a story point where her name, the daughter's name is Violet, like a shrinking violet. She hides behind her hair. And in this moment where mom tucks it behind her ear, it's our sign to the audience and to everyone that she's sort of emerging from her shell and she's going to use her superpowers. And the wonderful thing about Pixar is there's this real guiding principle about story. And so it doesn't matter what it is. If it's a story point, then we figure out how to do it. And so we drive technology that way, and it doesn't give you the luxury of saying, we don't know how to do that, or we don't have enough money to do that. It's like a just get down to brass tacks and figure out how to do it. And it's something that has made me utterly love that place. And so here's the scene that results in it. Maybe a little bright in here to see
if
too
the
much.
Time comes, you'll know what to do.
So, but we're not stupid after all. This lady right here was supposed to have long hair too, but it wasn't a story point. So we gave her this really nice asymmetrical 80s look. Okay, so another. Another thing that I learned in my time at Harvard was the power of technology. So as James was saying, we were here at about the same time, and it's like you come in, you don't even have email, and there's no such thing as the internet. I remember my first peek at the internet in the Science Center, and it was like some weird text on a screen, and Professor Joe Marks is telling me, like, no, no, you could probably find a job this way. And I was like, you're right, dude. I don't know what you're talking about. And then by the time we leave, we all have email, and the houses are all wired up, and I'm writing a website for the softball team. And it was sort of like back then it felt a little bit like computer science might open 10 or 100 doors, whereas now it's opening thousands of doors. And so you were only getting sort of little glimpses of what it could do. And so as another little glimpse, going back to my Harvard University mail service days, I had been working there for a little while, and somehow I saw how they were doing payroll. And I said, hey, I was rather horrified, and so I said, I could probably help you with that. And they were, what? I don't know what you're talking about. I said, well, let me just do this. And so I'm going to, let's say, programmed an Excel spreadsheet for them. It was like the simplest programming I had ever done. But, you know, they for them, it was like I was the second coming, or I guess the first coming of, like, the Postal Service God or something like that. I don't know. It was like the guy who did payroll, it was like his whole life had changed. And so I got a raise, and now I was making more than I made at dorm crew. And so in celebration, I had been messing around in my spare time with, I don't know if anyone remembers ResEdit, where you could kind of hack into Mac things. And so there was a screensaver, the Flying Toaster screensaver. Does anyone remember that? And so I was hacking the images in my spare time, and so I made Hums a screensaver that had the little mailbox flying by with wings and had Shirley saying, "Oh shoot, oh shoot," as she flew by. And you know, this time period was when with the Excel spreadsheet and the rays and the screensavers, I thought to myself, this technology thing might really get me somewhere. So for the power of technology, I get to witness this all the time in my work, and it's really quite wonderful from where I am. I work on the films for about 3 years now, and I'm at the sort of beginning stages where we're deciding what technology we need to develop for each film, and being in the middle of seeing those advancements and getting to help drive some of that. And so Brave was an interesting one where it's taking place in Scotland in the Scottish forest, and we've really felt like it needed to be this nice, lush, rich forest. And so we're looking at the artwork to get a sense of it. Maybe if we could dim the lights, if that would work. So these giant wide vistas and all of the wonderful sort of mist and weather that you get in Scotland. And then we're getting these wonderful paintings of the forest. And then we're getting these sort of more and more worrisome paintings where there's more and more detail, which means more and more things the computer has to compute. And then we get these photos from the research trip, and you can see all of this beautiful landscape and all the different vegetation and different grasses and mosses. And then we start getting reference from the art department like this. You can see this is photo reference too. I think there are about 20 more of these, and it was all about the different kinds of moss. And then we're getting these little vignettes of how this vegetation should go together. I know so much more about Scottish vegetation than I really ever expected to. If anyone has any questions, I'll be available later. And then we find out that the art department is making Photoshop brushes of lichen, and then they made more. And so we knew that we were all kind of in some serious trouble. So the movie we had made most recently before this was Up, and this is a stylized movie, so everything's sort of on a bigger scale, but this gives you a sense of where we're going. So here is Up, and here's where we had to get to. And so the level of detail was on a completely different order than we had done before. This coupled with the movie Avatar had come out, and this feeling of you always have to sort of keep up with the Joneses, and Avatar was such a lush, rich world that we felt like if we didn't at least come close to that, people wouldn't really buy into the world in the same way. And so what this meant in the wonderful times of innovation is you have to throw out everything you've done before and come up with a totally different way of doing things, which is the scariest but always the most exciting too. And so we came up with something that got dubbed Wonder Moss. It was originally just going to be used for the moss, but was so successful we used it for almost all our vegetation. So one of the problems is we need a ton of geometry. One of the cheapest things you can give the computer is just a curve. And so the first layer of this is growing curves on the geometry. So you can see we're doing grass and leaves and bushes and all kinds of things. And all of this is just generated by math at render time. It was done by this wonderful guy who, when he looks at nature, he sees math, where most of our artists have a couple math equations they can use to kind of do randomizations to make things organic. And he sort of sees it in the flip way. So the first thing is growing curves. I know you're looking at this and you're like, yeah, not impressed yet. So we grow curves, and then we turn on the next part of Wonder Moss, and it does this thing he called enveloping, which is sort of the bumping and clumping to get things to look more organic. And then we turn on gravity, and this is really all just in the mathematics of the curve, so very cheap still computationally, which is important for how much stuff we had to get on the screen. And then, of course, because we're doing vegetation, color becomes a very important part of sort of the history of vegetation, of what's fresh and what's old. In the computer, you can make the mistake of everything look like it's brand new, so we have to kind of build history into things, so again, it's a more believable world. And then this is my favorite one, is called extra curve variation. And you can't see it in this one very well, but there's little flowers growing in the grass. So I'll show you, this is an early development loop. And you can see here in a second that all of these clover are going to grow in certain patches on the tree. And the wonderful thing about this is the part of the code that's sort of adding the little oddities and spice of life that makes nature. And so what this is doing is calculating where the divots in the tree are with the idea that they would get less sun, they would be more damp, and that would be where the clover grows. We use the same kind of ideas and process on clumps of needles, so the newer needles versus the older needles, or having the flowers grow in certain places, or having this procedural wind that we turn on here in this next one only activate in certain places. So all of this is math that's getting all of this incredible organic nature into our movie. Now, most of the time when we use the power of the computer to generate our stuff for our movies, it only gets us part of the way there. What we really need is systems where we harness the power of the computer but allow the artist to have as much control as possible, because they can't be unlinked, or you end up with very sort of artificial looking things. And what we want is this sort of rich world that you can immerse yourself in. This is the example at Pixar that went the furthest I have ever seen. It probably was like 90% successful in all cases, so making it just look outstanding. The wonderful thing is that the engineer still went the extra mile and built everything in so that an artist can do whatever they want on top of this. And so if you need a path for Merida and her horse to walk down, you just paint in a path and the grass grows shorter there. Or if you don't like the clover where they grow, you can easily take it away. And so it was this magical combination of the two, so we had the best of both worlds. And so in the end, we end up with a forest with all of this detail, but we can change it around depending on the vegetation and get all these sort of different types of Scottish landscape in, by the castle or by the river and sort of changing the color of things or up in the Scottish Highlands. And so here's a scene from the movie, a shot in the movie, and this is how it looks coming into lighting. So this is coming into the department that I do. And once we get our lighting in there to set the mood, you can see how much it changes and maybe why I've fallen in love with lighting. And so this was this wonderful example of sort of heavy technology with the ability to do the art. But it's always a balancing act for us. And so Wally is this very interesting example of that, where when we got into making Wally, the people doing Wally's eyes got super, super geeked out about it. And they're like, we're going to make these like practically optically perfect lenses. And they studied camera lenses and all of the optics and got it just right. And then we went to light it. And what happened was Wally looked completely glassy-eyed. And so I don't know how many of you have seen Wally, but this is a movie about a robot who It's a movie about a robot that we have to believe like has a soul and a character and can fall in love. And so glassy-eyed is kind of the antithesis of that. So we knew we had a real problem on our hands. The other thing is that Wally doesn't have any traditional dialogue. And so the animators are really stuck with very few things for him to act with. So the binoculars are a really critical piece of that. He has his little eyebrow flaps, and otherwise it's just his body. He doesn't have a mouth or a lot of things to express with. So those binoculars are a critical piece of his acting. So it was really important that we got him right. So we went in to try and figure out how were we going to solve this problem we kind of got worked into by the technology where we couldn't actually address the story correctly with the eyes the way they were. So you can see Wally has three lenses here. Here's the front flat lens, and then he has a concave and a convex lens in there. So when we put all the reflections on, you can see it's definitely very glassy-eyed. We tried actually a lot of sort of stupid things that would have been sort of easy to pull off where we fake sort of blocking the reflection in there, but it looked very fake and distracting, or just turning it down, but then it doesn't actually look like the materials of binoculars. You know, the last thing we want is it for it to look like we put googly eyes on Wally. It would have looked really stupid. And again, like we never want to pull the audience out of the movie, and so we kept working on it. The other problem was, there were times in the movie where we actually had to see something reflected in his lenses, and so usually it's Eve. And we, you know, as he's falling in love with her, we understand that he's looking at her. Now, but in this image, we have controlled it so Eve is only reflecting on the front lens. And it's already glassy enough. And then we put Eve on the second lens, and you can see it's getting worse. If we put her on the third lens, she'd actually be upside down, which is even worse. So we're really kind of backed into a corner, so we still are working on things. We turn the reflection down. And then this is sort of the magic moment here. I don't know, can you guys see that? I know it's really subtle. But what happened was the lighting artist that I had working on this added a light to Wally, but messed up the shadowing, which means the light leaks inside the binoculars. Because the inside of the binoculars are black for the most part, it doesn't show up. But it hit the aperture blades inside there, which are gray. And what happens is that cuts through the reflection more so than anything else does. And so what we begin to see is we still have the reflection like it's a piece of glass, but we start to see what's recognizable as an eye. Because as a human, we have the white of our eye, the colored iris, and the black pupil, and suddenly Wally has the black of the sclera and then the gray iris and a black pupil, but we maintain that reflection so we kind of get the best of both worlds. So it ends up being this serendipitous thing that sort of pulled this all together. And so we have this moment where we figure out to do this, but then the really cool thing is that when we get to this last scene in the movie where, I hope this isn't a spoiler for anyone, but where Wally sort of dies and loses his personality, the perfect thing is to make him glassy-eyed, and so we take that light away, and we end up with glassy-eyed Wally feeling like he has no personality. And then once he comes back to life, we add that light back in, and the animators made him look wide-eyed and like a puppy dog, sort of, and so we get all the best of Wally back, and he returns to that sweet, soulful robot that we have come to love. And so while I learned about the power of technology at Harvard, I've really learned about the power of technology and art together to create something bigger and better than either of them alone. If you will allow me, Harry Lewis reminds me a little of Wally. because it's nothing about the glasses. Wally is this guy who searches through the garbage dump and he finds the little cast-offs and they're his treasures. And so I think of him as kind of the guy who finds beauty and value in what others ignore or cast off. I learned all these great things at Harvard that I've talked about, working hard, ignoring barriers, and how powerful technology can be. I also got to take amazing classes and get an amazing education, and was encouraged to be much bolder and bigger in my life decisions. But the most important lesson I learned at Harvard was from Harry Lewis, the one that has had a direct impact on me every single day. Like Wally, finding the value in what others would ignore or cast off. In a room where, as a woman, there were only 10% of the people that looked like me, he treated me like I deserved to be there. That is the most powerful and lasting gift you can give. Thank you, Harry.